Can you imagine running 105 miles nonstop around a track? How about racing 60 miles by running, mountain biking, and paddling? Today, extreme sports in Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every day in this state, athletes are pushing themselves to their limits. This hour, I'll talk to athletes who test themselves through adventure races and ultra marathons. And I'll take a very personal look at skydiving. We're taking our seatbelts off because apparently we're all going to jump out of this plane. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with athletes who push themselves to the edge. In a few minutes, I'll talk with ultra marathoners. And later in the hour, I'll try to figure out why people love to jump out of airplanes by going skydiving at Paradise Skydives in Vinton. But first, we're going to talk about adventure racing. The Boone Crusher is an adventure race of 40 to 60 miles. It takes place in the Des Moines River Valley near Boone. And the second annual Boone Crusher just took place at the end of April. With me now is Steve Oberbreckling. He's the co-director of the Boone Crusher. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And for people who don't know, what is an adventure race?
Well, adventure racing consists of mountain biking, orienteering or navigation, and then canoeing or some type of paddling. And there's some races that might include a rope section and other activities.
So orienteering, there is no set course? The competitors have to figure it out themselves?
Yeah, so the night before, the racers will generally receive their checkpoints in the form of a UTM coordinates, and then they'll plot those checkpoints on a map that's provided by the race directors.
All right, and with 40 to 60 miles, that means it can be kind of a different course every year, right?
Right, yep. It's definitely something different every year to look forward to.
And I suppose some of the competitors go a lot farther than the others if they don't do that orienteering right.
That's right. There's the orienteering is something that you really need to practice and work on. And there's teams that that race competitively, and there's teams that come out to just sort of have a good time. And so there is a big difference on what kind of racers show up.
You're the co-director of the Boone Crusher, but you are an adventure racer yourself. How long have you been doing this?
Yeah, so Jared Freed is the other owner of 41 North Racing, and we race together for a couple of years now. We've gone to Missouri and Kansas and as far as Kentucky to race. So, we sort of thought it'd be a good idea to have a race in Iowa near our home here, and it was a good opportunity since there wasn't really a large race in Iowa.
What is it about adventure racing that you love?
Well, the sport is an opportunity to, work on different disciplines. There's mountain biking, which is, a lot of fun. We do, we do some triathlons and things like that, but the adventure racing, you're really using your, you have to think a lot on your feet and make decisions. It's a lot more challenging in that aspect, and it's an opportunity to to grow as a team. You're going to race with two or four people. There's a lot of things that are exciting about it, and it really keeps you active throughout the year, training for it and preparing for your next race.
In creating your own race, mm-hmm. and you setting up that course, deciding what people were going to do, what did you take into account when you were setting up the course?
Yeah, so when you're designing a course, it's there's a couple of things to take into mind. We had the national champion team Wadali out of Minnesota race, and then like I said, you have teams that are just doing it for the first time. So you want to make it a course that accommodates, the fast racers and also the racers who are sort of just here to have a good time and to see what the experience is like. So, you try to make a course that's difficult and yet still enjoyable for the teams that are just sort of, like I said, having a good time. And in the central Iowa, the Boone area, obviously the Des Moines River Valley is predominant there, so we really try to work in those steep hills and valleys into the course, and that really presents a challenge that to a lot of the racers.
Do you go out and try the course yourself before the race?
Yeah, we go out and plot, or when we go out and place the checkpoints, we definitely, you know, have the opportunity to experience the course in that way.
So this year, the race took place on April 27th, which was an unusually warm day for April. It was probably at least 80 degrees, mm-hmm. bright sunshine. And the reason that I know about the Boone Crusher is because I was taking a leisurely walk on the High Trestle Trail with my family that day, and all these people kept coming past us dressed in black, carrying their camelbacks on their backs and looking pretty intense. We chatted with a few of them, and they told us, oh, man, this is awful. They looked pretty miserable. So that immediately brought up the question, okay, why? Why do you do it? It's got to be hard.
Yeah, this year, like you said, we were really blessed with the weather. We were sandwiched in between two really, you know, sort of nasty weekends. And the people came out and raced. It was a difficult course this year. It was closer to 70 miles on that 12-hour course, and those were the folks that were down on the High Trestle Trail. You know, I think it's one of those things that when they get finished with it, you know, they look back and it was, you know, sure it was challenging, but I think that they found out a lot about themselves as racers and as athletes. And you know, I think that in most cases, people are really happy with the results and happy with their performances.
What was your gateway into adventure racing? What were you doing before you tried this?
I had done a few triathlons before this, and that probably led a lot into it. I was in the Marines, so the orienteering and the navigation also came natural, and you know, just enjoying you know, mountain biking and being outdoors.
What is the toughest adventure race you've ever done?
I think this year, Jarrett and I and two other guys did a race in Kentucky. That was a challenging course. It was set up sort of like ours, except whether or not you got all the checkpoints was really left to the racers, and there was a lot of more ground to cover, and it wasn't expected for the racers to finish that course. It finished in terms of actually completing all of the checkpoints, so it was a very long
It's basically an impossible task.
Yeah, I think that they really didn't expect anyone to complete all the checkpoints, but just to, you know, get back to the finish line in time.
With adventure racing, is there kind of a core community of athletes that travel all around the country? Do you see the same people race after race?
Yeah, there's definitely a core community. There's teams from Nebraska and Minnesota and Missouri that, you know, we'll see a lot around the area that generally do the same races every year, which is okay because, like you had mentioned earlier, you know, the courses are always going to be different, even if it has the same race title, the same, you know, the name. The race itself will be completely different than the previous years.
How many people did you have participate in the Boone Crusher this year?
So we had a really great turnout, especially in terms of adventure racing. We had like 230 registrants this year. We had a few you know, injuries towards the race date, but we had a great turnout.
And will you be doing it again next year?
Yeah, we're definitely going to do it again next year. We're looking forward to that. Hopefully, we'll have a nice day, and it'll be an exciting race again.
Well, Steve, stay with us because we're going to talk more about what drives people who do things like this as we go on. But I want to introduce a few other people who do things like this. Daphne Donald is here. She is a runner from Muscatine and has completed 11 ultramarathons. Daphne, what is an ultramarathon?
Well, my understanding, an ultramarathon is anything longer than a marathon. A marathon is 26.2. So the first ultra that I did was an 8-hour ultra. So when I passed a checkpoint at like 26.5, the fella said, "Oh, congratulations! You've just done your first ultra marathon. You just passed that point." So it could be 50K, 50 miles, etc.
All right. So it's a long way,
right?
And how long have you been doing ultra marathons?
I just got into long distance running in 2008. My first ultra was in 2009, and that was the 8-hour ultra.
By saying you just got into long distance running in 2008, put that in perspective. Have you always been a runner?
No, I did some short distance, like 5Ks, things like that, but I had a group of friends that were doing a lot more running that I got involved with, and some of the friends that I run with have done, you know, close to 50, 100, things like that, lots and lots of marathons and ultramarathons. So to me, 11 is not as many as some people. So
well, you're well on your way. But so you started running marathons in 2008.
Right.
How many marathons have you done?
I've completed 12.
12 marathons, right. And 11 ultramarathons, right. In 5 years.
Yes.
Okay. That's a lot. And for people who want to get an idea of what 50 kilometers is, of course, it's five times a 10K,
right,
if you've ever,
right,
run a 10K. But it's also 50 kilometers from the Iowa State House to Jack Trice Stadium in Ames. So that'll give you an idea of how far that is.
That's right.
So once you ran your first marathon, what was it about that experience that made you want to go back and do it again?
The first marathon, I had a really good experience. I felt good at the end. It was fun. I had some friends, you know, that you hang out with. So I just wanted to try it again. I enjoyed it. Pushed myself to see if I could do a little bit better time-wise. Just keep going.
How much do you train?
I do about, now in the summer, I do about 50 to 60 miles a week. I'm very lucky. I have a very supportive family, a husband that also runs a little bit and will actually drive and sag for me. Like if I'm going to run out somewhere, he'll drive out and meet me. And
if you're going to do one of your
like
long
that.
Runs.
Yeah, and run with me a little bit and then, you know, drive home. So I'm fortunate. I have time to train, a lot of family support. So.
Well, for a lot of people, of course, gearing up for a marathon is a very big deal. And you focus on the training and doing the longer distances and building up. When you're doing marathons as frequently as you do marathons, do you have that kind of training cycle?
I do. If you're going to do, I try not to do more than one long run race in a month. So that gives you about 4 weeks to recover and then do a little bit more training before the next one. But sometimes they can get close together. You have to pay attention to how you feel and not overdo it.
Could you just go out and run a marathon on a whim?
Could I? I don't know. I mean, I probably could. I like to train because I like to feel like I'm in good shape. Plus, I like to rest up a little bit beforehand.
Well, you don't like to rest a lot. I'm going to call you out on that one, Daphne.
But yeah, I could probably do the distance, but it's just, you know, how you would feel after and how well you would do.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break and we will be back to introduce a couple more ultra marathoners to the conversation. Daphne Donald is a runner from Muscatine. She has completed 11 ultra marathons in the past 4 years. Also with me is Steve Oberbreckling. He is the co-director of the Boone Crusher, an adventure race through the Des Moines River Valley near Boone, Iowa. And a little bit later in the hour, we'll find out why people go skydiving, or at least I'll attempt to find out why people go skydiving by jumping out of a plane. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are exploring extreme sports in Iowa. We're talking about adventure racing, ultra marathons, and coming up in a few minutes, I will experience my very first skydive. Maybe my last. We'll find out in a few minutes. With me right now is Steve Oberbreckling. He's the co-director of the Boone Crusher, which is a 40 to 60 mile adventure race in the Des Moines River Valley near Boone. Adventure race includes running, mountain biking, paddling, orienteering, all kinds of things. Also with me is Daphne Donald. She is a runner from Muscatine who has completed 11 ultra marathons just in the past 4 years. And now joining us is Mark Thompson. He lives in Iowa City. He's also a runner and is a two-time winner of the Hawkeye 50K, which is a 50-kilometer race around Lake McBride State Park. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today. And give me a little bit of your background. Have you always been a runner?
I've always been a runner. Through high school and college, and then after that period, I decided to get into the marathon thing and did that for a number of years, not with as great a frequency as Daphne, but you know, focused on maybe doing one or two big races a year. And then when the Hawkeye 50K race came to us locally, it was at the end of a training period, and some friends and I said, well, we have to do this. It's on the trails that we train on, so we dove in and we fell in love with that sport.
So tell me about some of the ultra marathons you have traveled to do. You've done the Western States. What's that race like?
The Western States 100 is kind of the,
and that's 100 miles?
It's a 100-mile trail race, and there was a lot of factors thrown into it that made it really difficult. There's altitude, and then there's the altitude gain and loss, which, you know, going up and down mountains really hammers your legs pretty good for a Midwesterner. And it's a lottery system because it's such a popular race. You have about a 10% chance of getting in. They increase that chance if you fail to get in 1 year. So I threw my name in the hat the first year, and by luck, I got in, and I probably was in a little bit over my head.
Now, a lot of long-distance runners from around the world train in the mountains so that they get an advantage when they come back down to normal altitudes. How did you train for a race, a 100-mile race, in high altitude?
Well, the thing, I couldn't really simulate that, so I tried to simulate the up and downs. And the problem is there's a lot of short up and downs in Iowa and in the Midwest, but there's no, let's run for a mile downhill, let's do 2,000 feet of gain or loss at a single time. And I just didn't have that option, especially with the amount of time you need to spend doing those distances. So I would go to the Sugar Bottom bike trails and run up and down those. It's about a 10 or 11 mile loop, do that several times. And it was actually pretty decent preparation, all things considered.
With the uphills, I think a lot of us understand how that can be very challenging, but the downhills have to be a real challenge too.
I think there's more pain on the downhills because you're taking more of an impact, and it's something that's more difficult to train for. The uphills, it's more of an endurance thing, and out there, it really got to be a time to rest because I knew that I could hike or walk those steep areas, and the downhills, there's no way around it. Once you got very sore, you would lose a lot of time going slowly. And one strange catch-22, one problem with it is that sometimes the faster you go, the less of an impact you have. You're able just to, as opposed to absorbing that energy, you flow through it. And that's, I ran into a problem with that as well.
How long did it take you to do 100 miles?
Just shy of 24 hours.
Wow. How did that feel?
Like I said, I was a little bit over my head. I probably reached my limit at around 80 miles, and due to the prestige of the race, I knew I had to finish. I had a lot of people watching online on Facebook and a crew out there with me, and I just did not want to disappoint them. So I just persevered and you know, really went through a lot of pain that night. It's in a different category than other races that I've done.
So going through that pain, I'm sure if I had been on a leisurely hike in the woods that day, you would have said, I'm completely miserable, if you'd had enough breath to speak. So going through all of that pain, after you get done, what does it mean to you?
Well, there is a pretty great sense of accomplishment. I like the sport in that it's one I can be competitive in, although not in that distance or in that field. And it's just great to think, on a regular map, how far that is that you've covered. And also, I'm sure Daphne would agree that with trail running, you get to see so much. You're out in such a beautiful place. You get to pack a week's worth of hiking into one day or one afternoon. So upon finishing it, I felt like I could be part of that group. I could be part of the few people that had the opportunity to be out there on that course.
We're talking about extreme sports today on Talk of Iowa. With me is Mark Thompson. He lives in Iowa City. He's a two-time winner of the Hawkeye 50K race at Lake McBride State Park, and he completed the Western States 100, which is a 100-mile race in the mountains this year. Also with me, Daphne Donald, a runner from Muscatine who's completed 11 ultramarathons, and Steve Oberbreckling, the co-director of the Boone Crusher Adventure Race. And I want to bring Bonnie Bush into the conversation now from Bettendorf. Pardon me, Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Charity. Nice to join this group.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And you are also an ultramarathon runner. You've also run over 100 miles at once. You did that just recently. Can you tell me about that run?
I did. The local running club here, the Corn Belt Running Club, puts on a 24-hour run. We do that on a quarter mile, 400-meter track. And you get 24 hours to see how far you can go in that length of time.
And how far did you run on a track in 24 hours?
A little over 105 miles.
Wow. You went the farthest of anyone?
I did. How unusual for someone my age.
Well, how old are you, Bonnie?
I'm 55 years old.
Wow, that's incredible. How long have you been running these super long distances?
I started doing ultramarathons in 1988, on or about the time the internet started to get slowly active.
What attracted you to this?
Just like the other folks have talked about here, curiosity, you know, just to see what you can do, if you can do it. And, you know, you do get out, you get to see things that you normally wouldn't get to see or experience, either personally or the environment that's around you. So all those things kind of feed that curiosity.
Well, these long runs, these ultra marathons, 50Ks, they seem to be getting more and more popular now. Back in 1988, were they pretty rare?
They were. There wasn't a lot of them around, and you're absolutely right. We have a lot of races here in the Midwest. Steve talked about even our border states have a lot to offer. Even within the state of Iowa, there's a lot of races now that are over a marathon in terms of distance and length, either a time, you know, like Daphne talked about, an 8-hour. But there's a lot of 50Ks out there. There's 24-hour runs out there. I mean, there's a lot of things out there now that weren't there once upon a time.
How do you protect yourself from injury? I think a lot of us couldn't possibly handle that much running over that many years. How do you keep yourself in shape to be able to do it?
For me, I think Daphne talked a little bit about that too, is that you're always trying to maintain a certain level of fitness. And in many cases, you might use a race to actually improve your fitness or to test your fitness. And then you use a lot of cross training, you use a lot of variety, and try to do different things to just keep moving.
Do you have any injuries that recur for you?
I do from time to time. It seems to go in cycles, and those cycles may last a couple of years, actually. But you try to maintain some level of fitness so that you know you can do a certain amount of activities, and maybe you don't venture out as far as you would have otherwise or as far as you'd like to. So you try to curtail that a little bit in order to manage those injuries.
Steve, let me ask you, returning to adventure racing, you're covering a lot of different terrains, doing a lot of different stuff. How do you protect yourself from injuries?
I think the most important thing to do is to sort of stay active. A lot of what Bonnie just mentioned, you know, you spend some time mountain biking, some time trail running, probably do some swimming or canoeing if you have the opportunity. You know, generally just working out, you know, maybe 5 to 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day, depending upon what your goals are, of course, you know. So it's just important to stay as active as possible.
Do you have any chronic problems, any recurring injuries?
Not anything that is probably real out of the ordinary, you know, some, you know, Achilles issues every once in a while or a knee problem, but something that, you know, just pay attention to and maybe back it off when it's necessary.
How about you, Daphne?
I've been pretty lucky so far. I've had a couple issues with knees from time to time, but not enough to maybe back off a little bit, but it hasn't interfered too much so far.
It strikes me that some people's bodies are much more suited to this than others.
I guess, yeah.
How about you, Mark? Do you have any issues with injuries?
Not really. The race last summer, the Western States, took me out for a month or two. But other than that, I've been injury-free.
Do you do anything to try to prevent injuries? I mean, there have been all these debates about the efficacy of stretching and different things. I know a lot of people who run long distances do yoga. Do you do anything to try to prevent injuries?
I do a lot of core stuff, just stuff with a medicine ball or just regular core exercises. I mean, no specific routine. I do think that's important to keep the chassis strong when you go out and work on your motor, which is working on your aerobic strength. And so I think there's also a limit that you'll feel when you're out there and you're training. And if you feel that you can't hit those times that day or that distance that day, you just back off and think about the long term.
Bonnie, running 105 miles around a track in 24 hours, that is a lot of time to think.
Well, yeah, the scenery doesn't change very fast.
Right. What do you do to keep your mind active and engaged during that time? How do you handle it?
Great question. Unlike a trail run where the scenery is changing and you're really required to think and pay attention to where you're at and what's going on, the track forces you to think about other things and actively stay engaged. Interestingly, there's a lot of company that you typically have on the track because you are being surrounded by others that are doing the same sorts of things. So you actually become not only a participant, but also a spectator in the same event. You get a chance to, and at least for me, I've learned a lot from so many other people. Just engaging them in conversation. What are they doing? What are they, you know, what are their interests? What are they eating? What are they drinking? What is their training? What is, you know, what's on the horizons for them? And so you get a wealth of information. It's almost like reading a book and everybody's a book, and you get, you know, maybe several hours with a person in a conversation or a dialogue, even if it's a short dialogue. You can really develop a lot of information in your mind, and you can kind of work through that.
Do you have a training partner, or do you do most of your training on your own?
Mine varies quite a bit. During the week, I tend to run alone when I am running. I've got a chance to run with some folks on the weekend that are helpful to me in the sense that it kind of grounds me and grounds me in reality. So I'm lucky that way.
When you run alone, and I'm sure there are runs where you spend several hours running by yourself, is that important time for you?
It can be. It can also be a real curse, I think, for some of us as well. So if you're not feeling well or you've got a negative soundtrack that's running through your head, being alone can be very uncomfortable. You can really talk yourself into, you know, calling it a day and calling it shorter than what you'd like to. But also it can be the opposite. It can be a real expansive way to think and to challenge yourself differently because you don't have others that you can rely on. It's just you.
Daphne, what is that time for you, those long solitary hours on the road pounding the pavement? What does that do for you?
Well, I do run with the group on the weekends, like Bonnie said, and I do run a lot by myself because most people don't want to go for as long as I go. It takes longer during training because I will stop and get a drink of water. I'll stop and do not a lot of time, but so the training is actually it's a lot more time consuming than sometimes just the actual race. But I do sometimes if I'm in where I think it's safe, I will wear an iPod. I'll listen to music. Sometimes I'll start out by myself, run a little bit with the group, and then go by myself again just to break it up. But somebody asked me what I think about, and sometimes you think about everything. You think about work, your family. Sometimes you just think about the next mile. When you're going to be done, what I'm going to do later, and things like that. But I enjoy running. I don't mind running by myself. I do like training with the group, though. Breaks it up. And on the trail running, too, like some of the others have said, a lot of the trails, you are by yourself a lot of the time. Because even just a few minutes apart, you might not see that person because of the way the trail's going, or even just a few, you know, not even a mile ahead or a mile behind. But you won't see anybody for a long time. So kind of get used to being by yourself. I don't mind it, but yeah, you got a lot of time to think.
Mark, is this something that you feel like you need to do?
I think so. I mean, it's become such a important part of my life that I don't know what would fill that void. What type of racing or running or even just the training, I don't necessarily have to compete or hit all sorts of important events, but the training, it's never unpleasant. It's what I want to do that day. If it is unpleasant, I decide not to do it. I'm always happier the rest of the day when it's happened. And I don't know if there's anything that could ever change about that.
Is this something that you feel is a big part of your identity? Does it tell people who you are?
I think so. I mean, at the beginning of this, back in high school, everybody's looking for an identity. And that was what the group I became a part of. And that was the group that I was in college. And as I began to build a life and build my career, you focus on that for a while, and then you need to get back to establishing more of what who you really are and reach back to those roots. And it's a community that I'm very happy and proud to be a part of my friends, they're all involved in this type of activity. It's what I do.
Well, and Steve, it strikes me that adventure racing is even more of a social activity than ultramarathoning. Would you say that's true?
I would think that in some aspects it may be. I mean, you're certainly going through the race as a team, so you're going to struggle together and you're going to, you know, find out more about the individuals in your team. So I think it tends to, provide that opportunity to do that.
And is this an important part of your identity?
Yeah, I think so. I think, we work pretty hard, especially probably for at least half the year, you know, coming up with the course and how to advertise it. And then on our own racing, it's definitely a big part of our lives.
Steve, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks very much for putting this together. Really appreciate it.
Steve Oberbreckling is the co-director of the Boone Crusher, an adventure race in the Des Moines River Valley. Bonnie Bush, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Bonnie Bush is an ultramarathoner from Bettendorf. Daphne Donald, thank you.
Thank you.
An ultramarathoner from Muscatine. And Mark Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark is an ultramarathoner from Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment, we will explore the sport of skydiving. I will take a very personal look at it in just a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. After the door opened, I handed over my microphone, slid down the bench, and got down on my knees right on the edge of an open airplane door. For a moment, I held onto a small metal bar that was near my head. The wind was cold, blowing hard in my face, and instead of looking down, I was instructed to look up and lean my head back against my instructor's shoulder. It was the last moment I had to change my mind. But before we get to how all of that went, let's go back to the ground and talk with some of the other people who, along with me, are planning to do something that a lot of people think is terrifying, crazy, maybe even stupid. This hour, we've been talking about extreme sports, athletes pushing themselves, testing their limits. Now we're talking about a sport that's all about adrenaline. I'm at Paradise Skydives Incorporated at the Vinton Veterans Memorial Airport, standing just inside the large door of an airplane hangar. Along the back wall are a bunch of couches for skydivers to lounge on. The floor is covered with carpets where skydivers can spread out their equipment and pack up their parachutes. With me now is someone who just finished his first jump of the day just a few minutes ago, Jeremy Dubanski. Jeremy, how long have you been jumping out of airplanes?
This will be my second season skydiving, and my first actual season, I think, being president of the skydiving club at Iowa State.
And what made you want to get involved with this?
I wasn't quite too sure about the whole idea, so I went out and I made a tandem skydive, and I instantly fell in love with the sport. And I think the next day I went out and started doing advanced free fall courses and just started skydiving from then on.
Advanced free fall courses, so that's training to do this by yourself.
Yep.
As the president of the skydiving club, how many students do you have involved in skydiving at Iowa State?
We currently have over 200 members in the club. Not all are active jumpers. Most of them actually just do a tandem skydive. Most of the students will be doing that stuff. We have about 5 active jumpers who regularly jump on the weekends and sometimes during the weekdays.
How many jumps have you made?
Well, today it'll be around 250-something. We'll see by the end of the day.
How many times can you actually get up and down in a day?
We typically do about 5 jumps a day on the weekend, so 10 if it's a good weekend. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we usually jump, and we can maybe get 2 loads in each day of that. So our typical weekend would be about 14 jumps for a full week.
Where have you traveled to jump? Where's the most exciting place you've jumped?
Well, for Collegiance, which is like a competition for college skydivers, we went down to Arizona and competed. That was quite a bit of fun.
So a skydiving competition, what are you competing for? How does that work?
Basically what the competition is there's multiple categories. There's canopy accuracy, there's multiple stuff within free fall. There's like vertical falling and relative work, which is like laying on your stomach essentially. And with the relative work, you have about 4, 8, and maybe 12 people. And what you do is just try to build formations as fast as you can and try to beat the other teams in building formations. I actually competed down in Arizona for the canopy accuracy work.
How did you do?
I ended up placing 4th, but it was my first time being there. And this year we're going to try and bring down a few more people and compete in a wider range of categories and hopefully bring a medal back to Iowa State.
So I'm going to do a tandem dive today. I've never done this before. Do you have any advice for me?
Just enjoy it. A lot of people get up there and they become scared and a lot of stuff goes through their mind that's negative. But if you look up all the statistics and whatnot, it's a very safe thing. We do everything regulated. And a lot of people kind of, they miss the enjoyment part because they're so worried about the negative side of it. So we try to tell people to always smile and enjoy the free fall. And once you're in free fall, you kind of forget everything else and really enjoy it.
Jeremy Dubanski, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeremy Dubanski is the president of the Skydiving Club at Iowa State University. Now it's almost time for my jump. Before I get to kneel at that open airplane door, a very important part of the process is getting strapped into a harness, which is being done by the president of Paradise Skydives, Jay Spikine. Jay, thank you so much for letting us come out today.
Thanks for being here. It's always a pleasure.
All right, and I'm going to do a tandem skydive today, and you're going to get me ready right now.
Yes, I'm going to harness you up and get an altimeter and some headgear and have you ready to board the plane.
All right, Jay, how long have you been doing this?
33 years.
What was it when you first started that got you hooked on this?
I was actually going to Iowa State then. A friend of mine was a jumper and just mentioned it one night, and I think that was Wednesday. Saturday I was in a class and been jumping ever since.
So what was it, though, on that first jump that made you think, I got to do this forever?
I'm not sure how that process goes. It just seemed like a great idea at the time, and obviously it's been a lot of fun over the years. And you meet a lot of great people, too. The jumping is wonderful. The people are also wonderful.
All right. Well, let's get a harness on, and you can talk me through what I'm going to be doing.
Okay. First thing I'll have you do is step into the leg straps with your back. Hang on. I'm going to open these up so that they're easier to step into. Okay, just step right into those, and when you're in, you can pull those up. I'll follow you with the rest of the harness, and you can bring your arms in whenever you're ready, Charity.
This is the harness that will be connecting me to an instructor.
Right. Hold these two rings right about your hip bones, please. Thank you. I'm going to adjust all of these in sequence. When I finish up with this, it should be snug, but it should be comfortable, so let me know if it gets uncomfortably tight anywhere, and I'll readjust it. A couple things about the harness. The chest strap and the shoulder straps are going to look a little bit loose as you're kneeling at the door because you're crouched down and kind of hunched over. As you extend into your arch on exit, you'll take all that slack up. So you may or may not even notice it, but I just find if people notice it, and I haven't explained that to them on the ground, they find it disconcerting to see for the first time as they leave the plane. So now you know.
I brought my kids with me today. Audrey is 7, Carter is 5, and they are watching me intently. Are you nervous about mommy going up and jumping out of an airplane?
No. Now that I've seen it, I'm not really worried. All
right. What about you, Carter? Are you nervous about it?
I don't want you to do it.
But he doesn't want me to do it because he wants to go himself. Obviously, the people who are doing tandem jumps, usually, I would guess, have never done this before. What kind of safety precautions are there in case something goes wrong with that person?
Well, we have two parachutes. We have a main parachute, of course. We have a reserve parachute, which is the top half of this equipment. They're very similar in construction generally, although the reserves have some modifications to make them open a little faster and so forth. There's also an automatic activating device on the reserve. It's a pyrotechnic that basically severs the closing loops. Basically, it's designed if we pass a certain altitude and we haven't opened the main, it's supposed to shear the closing loops and begin the reserve deployment.
Now, when we were getting ready for this, I had to sign a lot of pieces of paper that said that if I die, it's okay, and I won't sue you. And I'm sure that there are people who when they even think about the idea of doing any kind of skydiving, think that's completely insane. How dangerous do you actually consider this to be?
I never sugarcoat it, and I occasionally will have people call up and say, please tell me that I'm going to be okay, or please tell me this is safe. I can't. I mean, I could say that, but I'd be lying, and so would anyone else who said that to you here or any other drop zone. I look at it as somewhat like driving. There's an element of chance to driving down the road, and there's also a part of it that is how we conduct ourselves. I mean, there are probably people you know that drive in a way that you wouldn't be surprised if they had an accident, and some that you would be surprised if they had an accident just because of the way they approach it. Skydiving's a funny thing. A lot of people think that we're attracted to risk. To be an old skydiver, you actually have to be averse to risk, or you will attrit out of it one way or another. What we do is try to engineer out what risk we can. And there's a lot of protocol, there's a lot of planning, a lot of training, and a lot of recurrent training that goes along with this. In inspections on gear, aircraft, the longer you're around it, the more you realize the people are having fun, but you'll start to notice that not quite as apparent underlying aversion to risk and that they're drawn to safety.
With the tandem jumps that you've done over the years, what would you say the worst injury that has occurred on a tandem jump has been with you?
I don't really have any injuries personally. I have had tandem students that have tweaked ankles. It's not a common thing, but of injuries, that's probably the most common since that's the first thing that we land on.
So you do so many of these tandem jumps. What are some of the reasons that people come to you? They must all have a story.
Oh, that's the fun part. Everybody's got a different path to that common point of jumping out of an airplane. Some people come out, they say, hey, my friends called me this morning and said they're going, and I had 5 minutes to get my stuff ready and get in the car. Some people come out and say, I've been waiting 30 years. I was going to, you know, back when I had kids, and I wanted to wait until they were out of school, or all kinds of reasons, or I'm 80 now, and I decided I want to cross off things on my bucket list.
You've actually had 80-year-olds jump with you?
I think Tom McClellan was 92 or 3. He's the oldest I've taken. We've had several 80-year-olds, yeah.
Are there any physical limitations? I mean, I can imagine that not all 80-year-olds are in tremendous condition.
Yeah, I tend to ask a few more questions if I know someone's in that age range. Some folks are in, you know, great physical condition. Some have issues, so I've been doing it long enough. I kind of go with my gut. Occasionally, I disappoint people, but sometimes that's just what's dictated. So I don't enjoy doing it, of course, but
it's the responsible thing to do sometimes. Yeah. Are there what would you say the most common occasion for someone going skydiving for the first time is?
A lot of birthdays, anniversaries, and a lot of people just want to. You'll know. I'll be interested to hear your observations when you get down.
Okay, now we have done a little prior training, but just briefly, talk me through what's going to happen in the plane. So I've got this harness on. It will be connected to someone else.
I'm very strict about that. Yeah, yeah, you need to be connected.
I, too, am very concerned about that.
Elliot Kelly is, Elliot was just here, but he had to hop on the plane. He's up with the tandem right now. As you ascend to altitude, there's a point where he will connect the hip and shoulder connections of your harness. Just FYI, the hip rings are 2,500-pound tensile strength each. Shoulders are 5,000, so the harnesses are quite robust. He will put a ripcord in, either on your chest strap, there's a little plastic fitting, or this one on the hip. He'll tell you which one he's going to install your ripcord on. You'll have a helmet and goggles on, and the experienced people leave first, so the tandems are usually the last out of the plane, and as everyone vacates, you're going to move to the door, position, and out you go.
Jay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity.
Jay Spakeen is the president of Paradise Skydiving. At this point, I've done everything I need to do, and there's a little time to wait and think. I think I'm ready. It doesn't seem like a very sensible thing to do, but seeing other people land safely is reassuring. I'm not scared, but I would say that I do feel a little anxious, a little queasy. It's not something that is on my so-called bucket list. I never thought I need to do this before I die. But when presented with an opportunity to do it, it's a pretty exciting thing. All right, the last group of jumpers are coming back into the hangar. The plane is ready. I walk out with another dozen or so jumpers. I climb into the back, and I sit along a long bench running the length of the plane. I am facing the back of the plane.
Okay, so we're getting ready to... We're taxiing right now, and we're going to take off.
It takes about 15 minutes to get up to 13,000 or 14,000 feet.
I'm leaning against the guy behind me. The guy in front of me is leaning against me. Everybody's packed in here pretty tight.
Again, I'm not wearing a parachute, so I'm very glad that the person sitting behind me is. Elliot Kelly is my tandem instructor. For his day job, he's a lab tech at the University of Iowa's pathology lab. In a moment, he will be connecting his harness to mine and pulling the straps very tight.
Taking our seatbelts off because apparently we're all going to jump out of this plane. My harness has been attached to Elliot.
The jumper in front of me is counting down the minutes, holding up his fingers. 1 minute to go.
Feels strangely secure for someone who's about to plummet through air. Trying to relax here. Feel the tension mounting a little bit, but I'm trying to combat that. All right, the door is open.
The cabin very quickly cools off. The plane empties out fast, one jumper after another.
All right, let's go skydive.
All right, the most important question, you have to get this right. Are you ready to skydive?
I am ready skydive. All right. 98% sure.
Whoa. Let's see if we can get those other 2%.
All right.
Then there I am at that moment, when I suppose I could still back out. In fact, my brain is screaming at me to turn back, but I obediently scoot on my knees toward the door and hold the bar above my head. I let go, lean back against my instructor. Elliot Kelly starts to rock us back and forth. One, two, and on three, we fall forward into nothing. I couldn't bring my microphone with me as we fell. The free fall lasts about 60 seconds. We were falling at 120 miles an hour with the wind battering my body. I found it really hard to breathe, and then Elliot tapped me on the side. I pulled the ripcord, the parachute opened, we're yanked out of our fall, and then float slowly to the ground for about 5 minutes. It is perfectly quiet and incredibly beautiful.
All right, that was amazing. It wasn't the sensation of falling, it was the wind battering me that was a little intense and made it extremely difficult to breathe. I was told that was going to happen. It wasn't that I couldn't breathe, it was that I felt like I couldn't breathe. And so I was really happy when it was time to pull the ripcord and the chute came down. That was a pretty crazy feeling too, though, just being caught out of the air. But the best part was just slowing way down and just coming down nice and slow and looking around at the beautiful, beautiful Iowa springtime. Would I do it again? I don't think so, but I'm awfully glad I did it once.
You have heard my skydive. Now you can see it. We have a link on our Facebook page, and we'll also post it on our website as well, iowapublicradio.org. A special thanks today to everyone at Paradise Skydives, my tandem instructor, Elliot Kelly, pilot Randy Brubaker, extreme videographer and photographer, and also morale coach Chris Wilkins. He helped us out a lot today. And Jay Spikine, president of Paradise Skydives Incorporated, for making all of this possible. Talk of Iowa is produced by Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical assistance today from John Pemble. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.